This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
What I want to do is to talk about the impact of Lucy on our understanding of the relatives, the other Australopiths. But I'm going to not actually be as inclusive as Dom was. I'm going just to focus on just a few of them. And it's already been made clear that there is a difference between the impact of Lucy as one specimen and the impact of Lucy's people or Lucy's kind, and those are two different things. And I will get back to that later on. Okay, 1974 was a long time ago. A Hungarian architect called Rubik invented a frustrating game. Eva Perón was elected the president of Argentina, and the Terracotta Army was discovered in Jian in China. It's a long time ago. And in 1974, these were the taxa that were recognized in the fossil record. And there are some lines in this diagram, but they're really hard to read because that is really intentional, because I am not as confident as some of my colleagues that you can work out which are ancestors and which are descendants. In 1974 was some years after Emil Zuckerkandel and Maurice Goodman had demonstrated really well that modern humans and chimpanzees were more closely related to each other than modern humans were to gorillas, and gorillas were to chimpanzees, which, if these guys are in a zoo, it's going to be a really confusing piece of information, because the modern humans are coming around eating ice cream, and they are more closely related to one of them in an enclosure than to another one. So if you think you're confused, just spare a thought for the gorillas and the chimpanzees. So this means now there is also genetic evidence, not just the evidence from the morphology of proteins, that that modern humans share an ancestor with the chimpanzees and the panins to the exclusion of the gorillas. So in 1974, we would have talked about hominids because we thought modern humans and our relatives were a distinct family. Now we realize that that is not the case, and so most of us refer to them as hominins and panins. So in 1974, that wasn't the case. And I like to really irritate the people who do all the hard work of looking for fossils by saying that one of the most important developments in human evolution in the last three or four decades has been the resolution of this relationship. Because this gives us something that we know as much as we know anything in science. And that's a scaffold on which you can hang the fossils, about which we inevitably know much less. Okay, because all we know about them are the hard tissues that preserve in the fossil record, and those hard tissues sometimes tell you whoopsies about how many species there are and what those relationships are. So what was known in 1974, and you've seen this, you've heard some of this before, there were two taxa from the caves in southern Africa. One was, the initial specimen was discovered by Raymond Dart, who was only 32 when he took the chair of anatomy at the University of the Witwatersrand. The other was the work of somebody Robert Broom, who is much better known for his work on therapsid reptiles than on hominins, but nonetheless, he was quite sure that Raymond Dart was onto something. So Raymond Dart was the person who discovered the first evidence of Australopithecus africanus. Well, not discovered, he recognized it, he didn't discover it. And Robert Broom is the person who recognized that what we now know as Paranthropus robustus was distinct from Australopithecus africanus. It's really important to emphasize, if you're not in this business, that the evidence from the southern African cave sites comes from a completely different context than the evidence from the landscape sites in eastern Africa. There is no landscape that you can really investigate in southern Africa, because the only thing you know about the landscape is the stuff that somehow found its way into the karstic, into the caves. So it's really important to emphasize that. And the problem is that sometimes when people who work in those places, they don't really know what's going on, they have a tendency to make it up. Bernard, you're a naughty boy. Okay. The other hominin that was known in 1974 was what some of us now call Paranthropus boysii, and was originally called Zinchanthropus boysii. And it was discovered in Altopi Gorge, as we now know it. The first evidence was this isolated deciduous molar, which was described by Lewis Leakey as a mandibular molar, and John Robinson, who knew perfectly well that Lewis Leakey's knowledge of dental morphology was about as good as my son's, and he's a gynecological oncologist, said, no, it's not a deciduous mandibular molar, it's probably a deciduous maxillary molar. But it was a large tooth. And it wasn't what the Leakeys, or at least Lewis Leakey, was expecting to find as evidence of the maker of the tools. So what they did find was this cranium, which in the spirit of the late 1950s was discovered by Mary Leakey but published by Lewis Leakey. This cranium was also not what they were expecting, because it didn't have a large brain, it had large teeth and so on. But nonetheless, it was the only game in town. So for a few years, Zinchanthropus boysii had a glittering career as the maker of the Olduan artifacts. But as soon as they found something that looked a little more like us, this poor guy was dumped, and then Homo habilis was replaced. If you're interested in why Zinchanthropus boysii and Paranthropus boysii is called boysii, if you buy me a drink and you have about 20 minutes to spare, I will explain. So then we come to Homo habilis, which was much more acceptable as the manufacturer of the stone tools. Larger brain, not so crazy looking, didn't have such large teeth. And there is the type specimen. And there is another picture of the people that Ian showed you. And my picture is better because it exposes Philip Tobias's rather interesting taste in sweaters. But nonetheless, they were the three authors of the paper which recognized Homo habilis. Then, as you've heard, the International Homo Research Expedition was put together by Lewis Leakey, and he invited Camille Arenbourg and Clark Howell. Lewis Leakey became unwell. He was replaced by Richard Leakey, and Camille Arenbourg, although he went there initially, he was replaced by Yves Coppens, who sadly died a couple of years ago. And then we come to Richard, who's the bad person in Ian's narration. And we come to Richard, who worked in worked at Cubifora. But before Richard went to Cubifora, he put together an expedition to go to Natron, and where they discovered this mandible, which although it was a mandible and OH5 was a maxilla, was clearly a match and probably belonged to the same species. And then, as you know, Richard, rather than go back to Ethiopia in 1968, went to explore the sediments on the eastern side of what was called Lake Rudolph and is now called Lake Turkana. Where, and I'm indebted to Dene Reed for this, where an extraordinarily large number of specimens were discovered in the space of just a few years. So it's not that the people at Cubifora had some rather antiquated notion of systematics. It's that we were finding so many specimens of clearly different species that we didn't know what was going on. And I must say that I probably influenced Richard, because I used to be a surgeon, and my philosophy is that you only operate on somebody when you really know what you're doing. And so we didn't know what was going on. It wasn't like Hadar, where they had the good fortune to find lots and lots of specimens of the same taxon, which allowed them to say, oh, we know what its limb bones look like, which was one of the really big contributions of Lucy. They could say, you know, these are the limb bones of this taxon. It could before we couldn't do that. Okay, so it's a very different ball game. Then, of course, Lucy really enabled. It wasn't the first discovery. You've seen this knee before. It's the most amazingly perfectly. It's such a perfectly preserved knee, and I did some time as an orthopedic surgeon. It just sort of struck me. You know, this is a human knee. So, the reason that we're here today was a discovery made later, which was of this associated skeleton. Now, the accumulation of more fossils at Hadar allowed the sensible people working there to look at all these fossils and to come to some assessment about whether all these fossils could be represented by a single taxon, or whether these fossils needed the recognition of more than one taxon, and they very sensibly decided that all the fossils, despite the fact that some are large and some are small, they all look more or less the same, and they should be assigned to a single taxon. This meant that the Australopith material from southern Africa was sort of displaced as being the common ancestor of all later hominins. And Philip Tobias's response was to say, well, actually, what they found in Eastern Africa is the same as what we have in Southern Africa. So it's not a new taxon, it's just a variant of Australopithecus africanus. And then in a much undercited but really good paper, White and Johansson and Kimball in 1981 showed that argument just had no basis. And that's a really, really good paper that every student should read. So let me get back to what I was asked to consider. I think Lucy's impact on paleoanthropology can be divided in the following way. It's the impact of one specimen, which is Afar locality 288. And that's an amazing specimen. It gave us an insight into limb proportions. It gave us an insight into posture. It gave us an insight into gait. So although one specimen doesn't make a summer, one specimen in this case was really special and it provided a lot of insight into whatever this creature was. The other thing is what that specimen, what it enabled. And you've already heard people talking about that. And Don quite rightly realized that an associated skeleton was evidence of the early stages of human evolution that people could relate to. It looked like one of us. Its skull is not that well preserved. The mandible's pretty good, Don, but the cranium's a bit sort of bashed around. And there are much better preserved crania. But nonetheless, a cranium which is isolated, you know, is okay for Shakespeare, but it doesn't really sort of catch the imagination of the wide world. So what Lucy did really enabled the work at Hadar to be supported by successful grant applications, and that meant that this person, Bill Kimball, who I still miss really, really badly, was able to work for season after season after season, not writing Nature or Science papers, but collecting the really hard evidence that you need to understand the paleobiology of a 3-million-year-old early hominin. It is really difficult to exaggerate how much all that grunt work, which didn't get a lot of recognition in terms of high-profile publications, how valuable that is. We miss you, Bill. And so back to 1974, just to remind you what we knew then, and this is what we think we know now. Now, in Richard's defense, if somebody showed that to me and said, you know, what do you think's going on? I think I would put a question mark on that. Okay, because I don't actually know how all those things are necessarily related. I know that they likely exist, probably not as many species as those, but maybe. But exactly how they're related, how I could tell a story about the evolution of the hominin clade, I can't do that. So, to go back to Lucy, just consider this sort of thought experiment, that Lucy wasn't female, but was male. And that Don was a fan of John Cleese, and the series 40 Towers was beginning around that time. And so Don had decided to call the associated skeleton Basil. Now, I just don't think that has the same ring as Lucy, okay? And it was really important that all those things came together. All those things came together. So here is my question mark, and my question mark is there for two reasons. One is that I don't know how much of the fossil evidence, which is reflected in that diagram, was dependent on Lucy being the ambassador. But Don, I don't think you can take all the credit. The credit really needs to go to John Lennon, who had a little help from McCartney in writing the song. And the credit really needs to go to John Lennon's son's Julian classmate, Lucy O'Donnell, who apparently was the person who Julian had sort of scribbled this thing with, you know, a girl and diamonds, because, you know, he was really fond. He had a bit of a crush on Lucy O'Donnell. So, Don, I'm afraid it's actually Lucy O'Donnell and John Lennon who are the ultimate cause.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.